the third and final case on the en banc oral argument calendar today is Gary Schmidt versus Ben Kiekhofer, case number 66528. Mr. Kozak, Mr. Hosmer-Henner, ready to go? Okay. Go ahead, sir.
I'm Charles Kozak, and I represent Gary Schmidt. In our view, the issue in this case is there clear and convincing evidence that Gary Schmidt intentionally libeled Ben Kiekhofer by publishing a statement that Kiekhofer supported Harry Reid in the 2010-11 primary for state senate. And, of course, most of the controversy in this case seems to swirl around an October 31st, 2010 article in the Las Vegas Sun, which we claim raised a strong inference that Ben Kiekhofer did support Harry Reid. Now, the defense brief states, and I think at a minimum, and this is quoting from their brief, the article, and this is referring to the Ray Hager article in the Las Vegas Sun, is whether the GOP, specifically Republican members of the state Senate, will retain Bill Raggio as the leader of the caucus. The article is not a story about Republicans who supported Harry Reid, but about Republicans in the state Senate who supported or opposed Bill Raggio, and this is the key, based on Raggio's support of Harry Reid. I think it's quite clear in the Las Vegas Sun article that Mr. Kiekhofer is one of those state senators that supported Bill Raggio.
Let me ask you this. As you read the article, and I certainly understand reasonable minds can differ, if I'm reading the correct article, some Republicans who talked to the Las Vegas Sun said they support the longtime leader, Raggio. Besides Raggio, the group includes Assemblyman Joe Hardy, Boulder City, who's running for state senator, Ben Kiekhofer, former spokesman for Governor Jim Gibbons. Anyway, it goes on. And the whole discussion before that was about whether or not Raggio was going to keep his leadership position. And why couldn't it easily be read to indicate that the Republicans that are supporting Raggio to keep his leadership position are those that are stated and the ones that spoke to the Sun?
That could be one interpretation of the article, but I think there's a strong inference raised here that when he's supporting Bill Raggio, based upon Raggio's support of Harry Reid, that he is in fact supporting Harry Reid.
Well, and then it goes on to say, specifically, Dean Rhodes of Tuscarora is not publicly, who is also publicly backed Reid and is not up for re-election. You know, they're kind of singling him out. It's just an argument point for you to address.
Well, that's really our position, that he is in that group, that you can raise a strong inference that he is supporting Harry Reid based on his support of Bill Raggio. So, it was about 5 months later that Mr. Hennessy, who was the campaign chairman for Mr. Schmidt, came across this article and brought it to Mr. Schmidt's attention. When Mr. Schmidt saw the article, he then did a lot of research to find out whether or not there was anything in the public record that said that Mr. Kiekhofer had supported Sharon Engel or had at any time criticized anybody who supported Harry Reid, who was a Republican. He then determined that he was going to compose an ad, and he did, and he sent out a challenge through Mr. Hager that if anybody could point to any publication of any kind which showed that Mr. Kiekeffer, in fact, supported Sharon Angle, that he would withdraw the ad. Nobody did, so he went ahead with the ad at various TV stations.
Counsel, let's go backwards a little bit. I appreciate your discussion about Ms. Angle, but we're talking about supposedly the endorsement of Reed in this particular case, and I'm just looking at this face, and I realize we've talked about our ineffective public schools quite often in the state, but the concern is what it says in the article, in a reasonable inference, and it's almost like yes means no and no means yes, so I'm querying a little bit, and as you go askew, what did your client specifically do to ascertain his reasonable belief, as you're putting forward?
Did he reasonably what, Your Honor?
His reasonable belief.
His reasonable belief? Because from the research he did, he could not find anything on the public record where Mr. Kiekeffer had supported Sharon Angle or had criticized anybody who was a Republican for Reed.
So that's a negative inference that in your mind translates to a reasonable effort to confirm the matters set forth in the article.
I'm sorry.
So that is a negative inference on your client's part that because he could find nothing that said support of the other candidate, he therefore must have supported Reed.
Well, that taken with the initial article where the Ray Hager article, which said that he was supporting Bill Raggio, and Bill Raggio was supporting Harry Reid.
Is it also reasonable that some people don't support any candidates, notwithstanding their party affiliation?
That would be highly unlikely in this race. It was the biggest race in the United States nationwide. And he's a sitting state senator, and he's one of the friends of Bill Raggio. I think it would be unusual for him not to take some stand in this election.
So the only evidence that you have in response to Justice Douglas' questions is that there is no opposite evidence, i.e., that Mr. Kiekeffer supported the other individual in that race, right?
No, there was no publication whatsoever.
And that's it. Okay.
Yeah. So as soon as the ad started airing, Mr. Hennessy it was brought to Mr. Hennessy's attention that there was a problem at the TV station, that Mr. Kiekeffer's campaign had complained to the TV station that the ad was inaccurate and should be withdrawn. Well, Mr. Hennessy immediately sent the Ray Hager article to the TV station. They looked at the article and came to the conclusion that they will continue running the ad. At that point, Mr. Schmidt, and this is like June 5th, had not heard anything directly from the Kiekeffer campaign about their complaints. Finally, on Thursday afternoon of June 5th, he did receive word that they were complaining about this particular ad. And so before he had a chance to do anything, he was actually served with a TRO. So he was had no contact with the Kiekeffer campaign. He found himself in court on Friday, 3 days before the election, in Judge Flanagan's court. Judge Flanagan took a look at the article, and his first reaction was, and I'm quoting now from the transcript, "Exhibit 4 seems to support Mr. Schmidt's position that there is a question as to whether or not Mr. Kiekeffer supported Senator Reed." Well, of course, Mr. Schmidt was in that hearing without a lawyer. Mr. Kiekeffer wasn't present. And so Mr. Kiekeffer's lawyers then, of course, proceeded to persuade Judge Flanagan that his initial reading of the article was incorrect. And so Judge Flanagan issued a TRO. And Mr. Schmidt actually went down once the TRO was granted and delivered that TRO himself to the TV stations, so that they would withdraw the ad, which they did. Well, after all this happened, Mr. Schmidt then filed the anti-SLAPP action under 41-6603A. That went to Judge Palaha. Judge Palaha ruled that the first prong of that statute Mr. Schmidt did pass in that the there was a public pronouncement and it was made in good faith. At that point, the burden passed to Mr. Kiekhefer under the statute to show that there was clear and convincing evidence that he would prevail in a defamation suit against Mr. Schmidt. Well, Judge Palaha found the article, and I quote, confusing, and then when he was, and Mr. Kiekhefer filed an affidavit. That's all he did. He wasn't present at the hearing. And when Judge Palaha reviewed the affidavit, he said the following. And according to the cross-examination, that's when Mr. Schmidt had been advised that Mr. Kiekhefer denied that. And again, we are in the area of political contest. And a denial by one candidate as an accusation tossed by another candidate, I don't think carries much weight because it is that give and take of a political campaign. So there needs to be more than just the plaintiff saying, hey, that's not true. But that's really the only substance that was in that affidavit by Mr. Kiekhefer. Mr. Kiekhefer did not provide any evidence to substantiate his affidavit. It was just basically self-serving, say, I never supported Harry Reid. He didn't submit any evidence that he'd made a donation to Sharon Angle. He didn't name any witnesses that would come in and substantiate that he never supported Harry Reid. He could point to no public statements that he had not supported Harry Reid. And he never disavowed the statement that was in the Hager article, where he could have said that he disagreed with Mr. Raggio. He had 6 months to do that, and he never did it. He never did it in court. He never did it in his affidavit.
Counsel, I reread the article. I kind of read it as saying that Mr. Kiekhefer was not a senator at the time, he was a candidate, that he supported Senator Raggio for majority leader. I mean, that was what the article seemed. The Reid comment seemed to be like a, I almost read it in the context of whether Senator Raggio supported Senator Reid as opposed to the other people. But why am I reading that article wrong? Could you tell me what your interpretation of what that paragraph says?
My interpretation of the paragraph is that Mr. Kiekhefer supports Mr. Raggio because he supports Harry Reid.
I see.
And where do you point me, please, to language that leads you to that conclusion from the article, if you would?
I don't have the article right in front of me, but it's that sentence that says that, as I recall, that Senator Reid does support Harry Reid. Senator Raggio does support Harry Reid and then quotes the various persons who say they agree with Mr. Raggio. And I think even the defense counsel concedes that that support of Mr. Raggio was based on his support of Harry Reid.
Could you address malice in the context of this?
Pardon me?
Malice. Could you address your position on malice?
Yeah, I think clearly that Mr. Schmidt was acting on a reasonable belief that what was in that Ray Hager article basically supported his inference. And then later on, when he looked at the record and couldn't find anything where Mr. Kiekhefer had supported Sharon Angle or had made any statements distinguishing himself from the four people who were supporting Bill Raggio. And by the way, in that article, there were many people who did just that. I mean, the article goes on, and Ray Hager interviewed a lot of these Republicans, and they said, we support Reid even though he supports, we support Raggio even though he supports Harry Reid. But Kiekhefer was not one of them. So he had an opportunity to distinguish himself from the people who were supporting Bill Raggio as a majority leader, but didn't approve of his.
Well, you don't know that, counsel. You don't know that, counsel. We don't know what the interview was between the reporter and the and Kiekhefer.
No, I don't.
I mean, that statement's a little broad.
Well, it is in the.
Did your client identify any information other than this article, any information anywhere that indicated that Kuiper supported Reed?
No, because he never had the chance. The only thing is the Hager article.
He didn't have the chance.
Because in the lawsuit, he was in that lawsuit before he could do any discovery. And
even before the lawsuit was filed. You said he put out a statement saying, well, demonstrate that you, what was your support of Sharon Angle? Did he pose a similar question? Show me that you didn't support Reed.
No, he just threw out the challenge that would you, if anybody can show that you supported Sharon Angle, then I will withdraw the ad.
I'd like to extend Justice Pickering's argument, if I may. The judge in this case found, for purposes of the legal issues, and the reason this is in front of the Supreme Court, is the application of the anti-SLAPP statute, whether the case should have been dismissed based on that statute. The judge said, under step one of the statute, that your client's review of the article was done without knowledge of falsehood. So in effect, he had satisfied step one and would have provided a basis for dismissal. So the second step is the question of whether or not Kuiper can demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that he has the ability to prevail on a defamation claim. The fourth element in defamation of a public figure requires a showing that there was malice with respect to a false statement. What I'm struggling with is how does one reconcile the trial judge's determination that Mr. Schmidt acted reasonably under step one and without malice, and yet found in step two that Kuiper could show malice?
I'm troubled by that, too, to be honest with you. I don't understand it either. And I don't understand how the judge could find that there was clear and convincing evidence of a defamation against my client when he said that the document or the Hager report was confusing. And then he said that he didn't give any weight to, or very little weight, to Mr. Kuiper's affidavit, which is about the only thing that substantiates damages, which is another issue. But they're being highly speculative at that point. But that's basically a problem, I think, that is not our problem. The burden is on Mr. Kuiper in that regard.
Okay, Mr. Kosek, unless my colleagues have a question, I think your argument's completed.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Hosmer-Hanner.
Thank you. Adam Hosmer-Hanner for Respondent Senator Kuiper. With me at Council's table is my colleague Mike Pawney. May it please the Court. The only issue presented upon appeal today is a narrow procedural one, whether the District Court correctly found that Senator Kuiper had established by clear and convincing evidence a probability of prevailing on his claims. Mr. Schmidt does not challenge the District Court's application of the elements of defamation. He does not challenge the interpretation of Nevada's anti-SLAPP statutes.
So do you agree, counsel, that under step two, a judge, when faced with this kind of a motion, is supposed to, in the context of a public figure, as Senator Kuiper was and is supposed to determine defamation as against a public figure?
Of course I agree with that, and the court did review the actual malice standard, and we certainly don't dispute that that New York Times or Sullivan line of precedent applies here. But what the district
How could the judge determine, in essence, reasonable and no falsity under step one, under a preponderance standard, and then determine the fourth element of defamation against a public figure under a clear and convincing standard, and conclude that a defamation case would lie?
Well, first, in our briefs, we take issue with the district court's determination about that first prong. We think that Mr. Schmidt should not have received the benefit of the protection of the anti-SLAPP statutes.
But we review that for abuse of discretion. So how did the judge abuse his discretion in arriving at the conclusion that step one had been satisfied?
There are two different standards there, the preponderance of evidence and the clear and convincing evidence standard that we're required to apply as respondent. So our position is that the district court did abuse his discretion on the first prong because he only looked at the definitional items 1 through 4 to determine that Mr. Schmidt's prima facie case fell within those definitional elements. There's a subsection that applies to the entire entire paragraph that says that there has to be a good faith communication, which is truthful or made without knowledge of its falsity. And we think the district court didn't actually reach that determination and only found the definitional elements was satisfied. So we think that was an error because, based on the evidence presented, it was not a good faith communication because it was not made without knowledge of its falsity. But here, specifically, there's a statute's pretty complicated and confusing because it shifts the burden so frequently, and it's been amended so many times that now, under this version of the statute, it raises fairly serious constitutional issues with whether it stops a party from even getting to the ability to present their non-frivolous factual issues to the jury. So here, the question of whether Mr. Schmidt acted with recklessness, acted with actual malice, is a factual determination. If a plaintiff is required to prove that at the very beginning, before they have the ability to conduct discovery, that stops their suit cold and prevents them from actually inquiring into that subjective determination.
But wasn't that the point of the anti-SLAPP statute? That's why the legislature enacted it.
Well, the legislature enacted it to stop frivolous and meritless suits. And that's
you haven't raised a constitutional challenge to the anti-SLAPP statute because you prevailed below.
We mentioned that in our brief and discussed it, that if the statute was construed in a manner to require require people to prove up their claim by clear and convincing evidence at the very beginning, that would pose a constitutional problem. And indeed, the Supreme Court of Washington has struck down an identical statute for being overbroad in that respect. Now, we haven't raised that challenge because we think through the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, you don't have to get there in order to find that Senator Kekeffer prevails. Because the point of these anti-SLAPP statutes was only to weed out frivolous and meritless disputes. That can be resolved legally at an early stage. But if it gets to the point where a district court is required to make complicated factual determinations, weigh those facts, and make a determination within the first 67 days, essentially, of litigation, as to whether a plaintiff has established by clear and convincing evidence a probability of prevailing on their claims, that's higher than what they may ultimately have to prove once they get to the jury. That's a standard that's even higher than their ultimate burden of proof. And we think that since it cuts them off from discovery, that would be an unconstitutional application of these Nevada anti-SLAPP statutes. But the question, going back
here, haven't asked this court to strike down the anti-SLAPP statute in this appeal.
We
seek that as an alternative basis for sustaining the district court's order.
We posit those constitutional issues as a reason to use the constitutional avoidance doctrine to construe the anti-SLAPP statutes in our favor to prevent that burden from being placed upon a plaintiff at such an early stage of litigation. So that certainly is an alternative. It's a tails, you know, we win heads, you lose situation, where if it's construed narrowly, Senator Kekeffer wins because he established that his complaint was not frivolous.
So you do agree with me that the district court's findings, that the statements made by Schmidt in connection with the ad under step one are internally inconsistent with the district court's conclusion under step two that a defamation case could be shown by clear and convincing evidence.
I do agree because we challenge that finding, but I also think that two different standards should be used there. Under the first preponderance of evidence standard and where the burden is placed on the movant, I think that's really a prima facie analysis under our statutes, where the court isn't weighing affidavits, the court isn't evaluating evidence. It's looking at the claims to see if those were accepted, do they fall within the anti-SLAPP statutes. So the court can
isn't
do that.
The burden of proof in a defamation claim against a public figure preponderance at trial?
I think that may be an open question. I think certain elements have been construed like actual malice to be an even higher clear and convincing standard, but that depends on the specific jurisdiction involved. But here, that preponderance standard, they're not the party bringing the defamation lawsuit. They're the party bringing the special motion to dismiss. And we think in order to qualify for that special motion to dismiss, all the district court was doing was a definitional analysis, saying, I'm looking at this motion was the speech in question without taking into consideration much evidence? Does it fall within the rubric of Nevada's anti-SLAPP statutes, section 41.637? And if it does, then the second part of the analysis is when the court actually starts making its factual determinations.
Well, the statute itself says the relevant communication is made in good faith if the communication, quote, is truthful or is made without knowledge of its falsehood. And the judge said that's what Schmidt did.
And that's a different standard than recklessness. So there's a different standard there. That language is not identical to what actual malice requires, which requires then knowing that your statement is false or with reckless disregard to whether it's true or not. So he could have made that determination by finding that the individual, that Mr. Schmidt, uttered his statement without knowledge that it was false. That's not necessarily inconsistent with a subsequent finding under the actual malice standard that Mr. Schmidt acted with reckless disregard as to whether his statement was false or not.
You just conceded a minute ago that that's exactly what you're arguing in this appeal.
I'm arguing both. The first position, we're saying it's not a good faith communication because he actually had knowledge that it wasn't truthful. But we're also saying under the second prong that even if you find that he didn't know for sure that it wasn't truthful, and the record supports that conclusion, he still acted recklessly based on making and uttering his statement based on an article that does not claim what he says it claims. And then second, giving an interview to a reporter a few days before the election saying, I will pull this out if any evidence comes to the contrary. That shows that he entertains serious doubts as to the truth of his publication. That alone shows recklessness with regard to whether someone is actually speaking who believes in what they're saying. We say when a politician makes an attack ad, there could be a lot of disagreement with that advertisement. But when a politician makes that ad and says, I have no idea whether it's true or not, and I'll pull it if anyone disproves me, that allows a factual finding of recklessness. And we think that the district court here weighed that evidence, took live testimony from Mr. Schmidt, evaluated that testimony, and said, I think Senator Kiekever has a probability of prevailing on showing actual malice. We're not here today to prove that Mr. Schmidt acted with malice. We're not here to prove he acted with recklessness. We are only here to show that the district court was correct when it found that there was a probability, once it got to a finder of fact, that Senator Kiekever should so establish. And I'd like to go to the specific elements of defamation. Now, Mr. Schmidt only takes issue with the factual findings the district court made, and we think that a deferential abuse of discretion standard should be applied to those factual findings because this court doesn't sit in the same position as that district court that took live testimony from those witnesses. Now, the district court found that the statement, there was a probability that Senator Kiekever could show the statement was false, specifically because there was no evidence to the contrary. They found that there was no evidence that they found that the statement could be construed as defamatory based on the evidence in the record, and they found that the statement could be construed the district court found that the statement had been published to third parties. There was no doubt about that. It was a defamation per se case, so it reflected upon Senator Kiekever's reputation, his fitness for his occupation. So all of these elements have been established by more than a prima facie standard. They've actually been shown by quite amount of unrefuted evidence in the record. And put that all together, and it shows that Senator Kiekever has met his burden, which is a low one, to defeat a special motion to dismiss. Again, this is a procedural standard that applies at the very beginning of the litigation. This isn't an ultimate finding on any of these facts. This is a question of whether the district court found that this suit was not meritless and not frivolous. And I'd like to go a little bit to that standard and talk about the Las Vegas Sun article. We don't concede whatsoever that this article is susceptible of multiple interpretations. We don't concede that this article even says that Senator Kiekever supported Senator Raggio on the basis of his endorsement of Harry Reid. That's all contrary to the article. But the timing of this article is important, too. It was published in 2010, 4 years before the events in question. This isn't hot news. This isn't something that came up and didn't give the parties time to interpret that article. Instead, it was a four-year-old article, and there was no due diligence put into examining whether this article was correct. Mr. Schmidt was notified that this article did not say what he claimed it was. He continued running the advertisement. Then the first judge told him, this article does not say what you think it says. And in that hearing, Judge Flanagan was responding to kind of the selective quotations of Mr. Schmidt, was initially confused, and within a matter of seconds went, I'm mistaken.
Then what's your position? What do you think the article says?
I think it's unequivocal. I think that this clearly says that Senator Kuykeffer was one of a member of a group of Republicans who supported Senator Raggio for his majority leadership position. In fact, one of the sentences, to go back to one of your questions, said, five said they support Raggio or think his leadership is inevitable, although most say they disagree with his Reid endorsement. There's no indication in this article that these people are supporting Raggio because of his endorsement of Reid. And so if this, you know, if this were a multiple choice question about what that pronoun meant, there's only one correct answer there. There's no partial credit for inserting Harry Reid in brackets. The only correct interpretation of this article is that Senator Reid, that Senator Kuykeffer was supporting Senator Raggio for his majority leadership position. And even if there's negligence here, even if they misread this article, we understand that doesn't amount to actual malice. That doesn't prove defamation. So just misreading an article and then publishing something on that basis doesn't get you to the point where our claims would necessarily have a probability of prevailing. But publishing this article, publishing the advertisement based on this article, being informed that there's a dispute as to the truth of your advertisement, going back and rereading the same article and coming to the same conclusion, that could show recklessness. But most importantly, Mr. Schmidt gave that second interview where he said, yeah, that article is my evidence, but if you or anyone else comes up with evidence to disprove me, I'll go ahead and pull the article. That's not a good faith representation that he believes in the truth of his advertisements. And then finally, now that my time's winding down, I want to discuss a little bit about the context of these anti-SLAPP statutes and what they're there for. Now, originally they were passed.
Well, did he say, before you do that, did he say you could disprove it, or he said if you could come forward and show that he actually supported Engel? I mean, my understanding was the latter. He was trying to box him into, it isn't enough that you say I've never supported Harry Reid, but you also had to say I supported Sharon Engel.
Right. He said if you can come forward with any evidence that you supported Harry Reid's opponent, then I'll pull the advertisement.
Okay.
So that, you're right. That's even more of an extreme admission that he doesn't know if the truth of his assertive statement, his affirmative statement, it was correct. Now, these anti-SLAPP statutes were passed for a very specific purpose, to prevent frivolous and meritless lawsuits from chilling the free speech from otherwise legitimate actions. But what they've turned into, because as they've been expanded, is really a tactical procedural tool for a lot of parties to gain that procedural advantage by bringing this motion at a very early stage of litigation. Corporations have begun abusing the anti-SLAPP statutes to gain a tactical advantage based on this very high initial pleading burden. And courts have retracted, and California and Washington are the main ones, who have said that imposing that very high procedural burden at an early stage of litigation is unconstitutional, potentially, unless we construe it in a way that it doesn't stop people from asserting otherwise legitimate claims. Senator Kuykeffer's claim is legitimate, and we should have the ability to go forward and proceed with discovery.
Okay, are there any additional questions from my colleagues? All right, thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments here today, and this case will stand submitted, and we'll take it under submission.